allow euthanasia for the mentally ill beginning in March of next year.
Really, it's you can turn it into a critique of Canada as a socialist hell, that we're killing people rather than taking care of them from a right-wing perspective. But from a true progressive perspective, you'd say we should be giving these people quality of life where they wouldn't want to take that option.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's the same with owning a gun, oddly, is that, like, if you're having a bad day and you don't have a gun, the odds of you killing yourself are much less.
But I got to tell you something. I got into this 10 years ago. I was sort of a public radio guy trying to figure out my next move, and I stumbled upon your show. And so I owe you something, not just for the time I spent listening to your show, but it was definitely a point of inspiration. So it had an impact on my life, the work that you do. Thank you for that.
Oh, great. You're welcome. Okay, so when I come up there next, we'll hang out, and you'll show me Toronto.
I'll show you good stuff. I don't have to just bum you out. There's good stuff, too.
Good. Thanks, man. Good talking to you.
Likewise, Mark. Thank you. Hey, that's your Canada Land. Hey, we've got a few jobs up at canadaland.com/jobs, and a couple of them are closing soon. Come have a look at our website and see if working here might be right for you. canadaland.com/jobs. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and our technical producer. Special thanks this week to Dory Smith, Jessica Valentin, and Brendan McDonald. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Jaskaran Sandhu, co-founder of Buzz News. Welcome back to Shortcuts.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
Today on the show, Gojo Tour Star Post Star Royco. Corporate newspaper consolidation got us into this mess. Maybe corporate newspaper consolidation can get us out of it. And is India assassinating people in Canada now? And finally, a blistering journalistic expose of a junior high school. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. All right, Jaskaran, I want to get right into this news that broke earlier this week. The talks are on for a merger between Torstar and Post Media. You catch this?
Yeah, I saw it go around on social media yesterday. Obviously, always piques interest.
I would say probably the worst case scenario, our news editor, Jonathan Goldsby, remarking on Twitter that, you know, the last good daily city newspapers in Canada are the Toronto Star and the Winnipeg Free Press, explicitly because they have not been consolidated by massive newspaper chains. And really, everything that we talk about in Canada Land, about what's happened to the media in Canada, there are a lot of factors that go into this global trends. But in Canada, really, a lot of this can be laid at the feet of Stephen Harper, who allowed foreign owners to take over Post Media. There were bids from domestic players for some of these papers. Like, if these papers had stayed in local hands, if we hadn't allowed consolidation, if we hadn't allowed foreign ownership, a lot of this would not be happening. But yeah, here's the news. NordStar Capital, the company which controls the Toronto Star and Metroland Media, is in talks with Post Media, the publisher of the National Post, Toronto Sun, and other daily newspapers across this country. They put out a press release. They only put out this press release because, like, for, like, security violation insurance, Post Media stock was, like, suddenly up by 50%. There's always weird stock activity prior to these big moves in Canadian media. Like, somebody's making a buck. But yeah, that's why they came out with this. And it's a bit complicated. It looks like they're going to form, like, two new companies that Andrew McLeod, the CEO of Post Media. He'll be the CEO of both of them, as far as I can tell. They're trying to keep the Toronto Star itself the appearance of editorial independence. And I think that's sort of what was promised to the prior owners of the Toronto Star. Like, don't worry, that'll never be sold to Post Media. It's totally being sold to Post Media. NordStar will keep a 65% stake in Toronto Star Inc. The press release doesn't say who gets the other 35%, but this is a merger. I'm assuming that it's Post Media. But everything else, including the Hamilton Spectator, it's all going to be Post Media, Torstar, one company. Jordan Batove as publisher of the Star and Andrew McLeod as CEO of the whole shebang. Holy shit.
Yeah, to your point, it almost really felt they begrudgingly put out that statement. It's like they're not interested in doing it. They did not want to do it, but they begrudgingly did. Obviously, like an earthquake of sorts in the Canadian media landscape, which probably stresses the importance of independent outlets in the wake of another consolidation of, you know, mainstream institutional Canadian media.
You want to hear some fiery rhetoric? Here's some fiery rhetoric for you. There's a cancer on Canadian journalism. The malignancy is Post Media. Jaskaran, is that me, some opinionated loudmouth podcast? No. Where did I read that? I read that in the Toronto Star in 2016. Business columnist David Olive called Post Media a cancer. And here's how he described it. He got into some detail. Canada's free press and the citizens it serves are paying a heavy price to satisfy the short-term profit-seeking of U.S. financiers who now control many of the leading originators of news in Canada's largest communities. Hedge fund investors and Post Media thrive on acquiring distressed properties on the cheap and milking their remaining assets. One would think that their slash-and-burn tactics at some of Canada's most important media outlets to make debt payments to offshore debt holders would be of more than slighting public interest. Instead, the Post Media story has been reported as the magical thinking, listen to this part, the magical thinking behind merging two troubled newspaper chains in the expectation that one prosperous one will result. In the looking glass world of financial engineering, you can profit handsomely from an asset of steadily declining value from picking the carcass clean. That's what I read in the Toronto Star, talking about Post Media. That carcass is now going to include the Toronto Star. The Montreal Gazette has one senior editor left. Okay, Jonathan Goldsby also took an issue of the Saskatoon Star Phoenix, a Post Media paper, on like a Thursday, a random day, and just went through it. He found one original article that was written by that paper's newsroom. Like, these papers don't even have physical newsrooms anymore. They have smaller staffs than Canada Land. That's what Post Media does to newspapers.
Have they tried getting money from the government? Is that a solution that they've exhausted, or is that not on the table?
Well, we also heard this week that after Facebook announced that, yeah, they will be cutting off news on Instagram and Facebook to all Canadians for all news. And, you know, as a result of C-18. And so having made a mess of news in Canada, Pablo Rodriguez, the Heritage Minister, was asked, like, what's next? And he said, resources will be made available. Like, I'm not going to tell you what the plan is, but if the money isn't coming from Facebook, we'll make you whole. We promised you cash and we're going to get it somehow, which doesn't really help those of us who refuse to take government media subsidies. Goldsby, who I'll quote again, he had a really good observation where he said, Post Media makes a lot more sense when you recall that its executives were the people who helped see BlackBerry through the iPhone era. Guys like Andrew McLeod, these guys are specialists in juicing value out of dying companies. What a mess. And yeah, I think that you could lay the original sin at Stephen Harper's feet. But, you know, you break it, you bought it. Like, the Trudeau government, the original position was, we can't get involved. You know, if this is an obsolete business model, it's got to run its course. We're not going to bail out the dinosaurs. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. That's what they originally said. And then, you know, I think they got frightened by things like Rebel News and by what was happening in the States. And then I think they were lobbied heavily and they said, okay, we've switched completely and we've got three major bills. We're going to get involved in the media like never before. And it's just a few years later, look at the shape of things. I mean, it is unbelievable how bad things have gotten.
Yeah, this is the, like another manifestation of the great debate is journalism and the business of journalism still like this philosophical intellectual exercise of telling the news, sharing stories, and aspiring to some greater good? Or is it just a pure capitalist exercise of let's just drain as much money out of this as possible. And for her mainstream players, it really does feel like it's swerving to the latter. And they're just not, they're not able to figure it out. And kind of goes back to the point, I think the folks that are kind of still doing the more philosophical, intellectual exercise of journalism is independent media. I don't think that changes. I think that's just the nature of what we're in, the time we're in. More people are going to lean on independent media in light of things like this.
Jaskaran, I ain't an intellectual and I ain't a philosopher.
Not that you know.
Not that I know. Post Media has never turned a profit, and Bell Media loses money on CTV News, the number one news network in Canadian television. They lose money on it. So I don't know what, like, you know, when you hear about Post Media gobbling up Irving Newspapers, Brunswick News, gobbling up Torstar, merging whatever, I think you think of like a corporate behemoth that just cares about making money. They don't make money. They make money for their debt holders, but they're not actually turning a profit. I'm sorry to be a broken record about this, but the corporate news leaders in Canada are no longer in the news business. They are no longer trying to make money off news. They've got a series of weird schemes and subsidies and, you know, gambling operations and debt structures and stock manipulations. They're not actually in the business anymore. It's not necessarily the profit motive or capitalism. It's corporatism that is just destroying the sector in Canada. And it's grim, man. It's grim.
Look, and what the cancer kills first is local news. That's what's dying. And no one's telling the ground stories where they happen. That's what's missing. And it sucks because Toronto Star did that better than most. If we lose that, that's a huge detriment to Canadians.
I hear you there. And there's still enough value and there's still a lot of great journalism for the Toronto Star. And I feel so bad for everybody who is obviously quaking in their boots there. And you know who else I feel bad for? Facebook turning off news for like Canadians, like that's so weird. Like, I don't know where else in the Western world, what's going to happen? You're going to try to share a news story in Facebook and it's going to say, sorry, this service is not available in your region. That doesn't really affect Canada Land as a podcast company. It's not really going to hurt our traffic. You know, we saw our Facebook traffic deplete over recent years, as every news company has. But, you know, talking to Jeff Elgee, the publisher of Village Media, they rely Facebook traffic for a significant chunk of their like profitable business. You run Buzz News. Like, how big a deal is Facebook traffic to your overall business model?
Instagram is much more important than Facebook. If you're going after a younger demographic, you know, Facebook is less relevant than I think it used to be. Instagram, Twitter are much more important to us. But for a lot of media outlets, especially ones that kind of operate, you know, quote unquote, ethnic media, like they really rely on Facebook. If you're a news outlet that's targeting an older generation, you still very much rely on Facebook. You know, people get their news from social media. That's just the reality of it. Whether it's Facebook or Reddit or Twitter or Instagram or whatever it may be, social media is how they capture it. They're not going to, you know, www.thestar.com and looking up the news of the day. It's what's being shared by their peers. And so policing that is actually gatekeeping the news in a big way for a lot of folks that do rely on those mediums to capture it.
Are you getting any of like the Facebook deal money or the Google
initiative? I haven't actually pursued it in any shape or form either.
So as a small news publisher, the effect of government intervention in this sector has been like to shut off an important source of traffic for your fledgling startup news site. Why do I sound like the angry one? If I were in your shoes, I'd be furious right now.
Maybe it's our expectations are leveled differently, man. I don't expect anything from this government for them to make wise decisions that will benefit independent media in any kind of significant way.
You know what? I never wanted any benefits or any kind of handouts for media. I just like, I'm enraged when they actually like actively hurt us. That's the part that gets to me is like, you know, to actually be risking your money and your time on trying to start something in a very difficult sector and have your government like, oh, you built up a Facebook audience? Well, that's gone.
Yeah, screw you. Look, I think this is just a bigger indictment of this government. It proves once again that they believe they're the smartest guys in the room and they don't do a good job of listening to stakeholders. And this is like across verticals. This is not just specific to media, and they just fumble it every time, and it's a symptom of just not listening to all stakeholders.
Jaskaran, we duly note stories that might otherwise go overlooked. Do you have something to point out today?
Yeah, sticking to the theme of the segment we just did, the Samara Center, which is an important institution that looks at the health of democracy in Canada, just released a report, a SAMBOT report, looking at toxicity during this last municipal election cycle. And the findings are actually pretty alarming. And I think that report deserves a lot more attention from our press. The kind of identity attacks that politicians are, or candidates even, are open to, kind of threats that they face, it really does hinder the ability to attract really good candidates.
Get specific here. What happened? I missed this. What was the attack?
So I can give you my example. I am a failed municipal candidate mm-hmm. from this last election cycle, and I was actually the most targeted city council candidate for hate and abuse.
According to Samara?
According to Samara's SAMBOT report.
You seem like a nice guy. Why do people hate you?
You know, Matt, people hate bald guys. I don't know what to tell you. No, but most of the attacks that I got were identity-based, and it was a direct relation to my advocacy in Sikh community issues, and it was an example of foreign interference. The attacks were coming primarily from Indian bots, sock puppet, and user accounts, and that is just one example of what candidates are faced with when they decide to run, and opening up the conversation about what are we going to do to continue to fight hate and toxicity in our democratic and political landscape.
And sorry, what were you running for?
I was running for city council in Brampton.
India is interfering at that level, at the city council level in Canadian politics?
Oh, 110%. Like, it's the proof is in the pudding. People that would actually publicly state they're supporting me would also get attacked. I had one old lady message me on the side. I tweeted support for you, but then I deleted it because I started getting attacked. But I want you to know that I still support you. So I have a multiple cute stories like that, but it is a reality. And you'll be surprised that foreign interference happens at the municipal level. It also happens in nominations and leadership races. It's everywhere.
One might say, I don't know, this is a crazy novel idea. I want full credit for it. Perhaps a public inquiry is needed. I don't know. Duly noted. All right, I have one. This is something, a follow-up on last week's episode. Last week's episode, I had Ethan Cox on, and we were discussing the tragic story of the people on the submarine. And Ethan Cox said that the incredible expense that was taken to try to rescue these people, maybe they should be charged if they are rescued, and they of course tragically died. But he pointed out that there are certain instances where if people were really reckless and endangering themselves and massive expenses were required to come and find them, sometimes they are charged for the search and rescue. And we got some emails back from people who do the search and rescue, and they said, don't spread that around, because there are people who are stranded in the wilderness who don't ask for help because they're afraid of getting a bill. And they're actually putting their lives in danger, and we want them to ask for help, and we want them to know they're not going to get charged for that, because people have died because of a fear of being billed for their own search and rescue. Now, there's no correction necessary. Ethan wasn't wrong. There are certain limited instances in Quebec where you might be charged if you recklessly endangered yourself and there was a huge search and rescue operation. I would argue you should still not hesitate to ask to put out all flares and signals. But the emails we got specifically were from BC. If you are stranded in BC, it doesn't matter what dumbass thing you were doing, backcountry skiing or ski boarding, or you put yourself in the path of an avalanche, or I don't know what kind of jackassery you're up to, you're not going to be financially on the hook if you need help. please ask for help if you have the means to do so. I wouldn't want to be involved in putting out information that would stop people from requesting the search and rescue that they may need.
Duly noted.
At a middle school outside Toronto, an anonymous letter written by a teacher describes an atmosphere of violence and indignity. Students will throw empty cups at teachers' heads, and students have defecated on the floor of washrooms and rubbed their feces on the wall.
Yuck. Wow. What?
Just classic school things.
I was a class clown. I rubbed their feces on the wall. I actually knew about this or some of this. We got a letter. It was signed. I'm not going to say who it was signed by because I think they would probably lose their job. But we got an email on May 18th about this school from Tompkin Road Middle School, Peel District School Board, Mississauga, suburb of Ontario. And it was really describing this is 11, 12, 13-year-olds. This is a junior high, middle school, and seemed to be from a teacher who was telling us, help us. Sending a letter to the media, help us. This school is out of control. kids are like beating each other up and taking videos of it and sharing it with each other. There's a series of allegations, blowing in teachers' ears, swearing at teachers. There was just like a list of things. It's certainly an interesting story, but we had a newsroom conversation about it. Like, how would we possibly go about verifying this? You're talking about like 11 and 12 allegations of things that 11 and 12 year olds did. Like, are we going to go investigate whether kids did these things? And some of the things are so specific that even if we leave the kids' names out of it, which of course media would, people in that community would probably know in certain instances which kid you're talking about, whether they did it or not. That's the kid who was accused of throwing this thing at a teacher's head or smearing their feces on the wall. So I don't know. While we were having that conversation, it turned moot. We got scooped by reality. This Twitter account, R. Michael Tepper, he said, "This morning I received this letter from a teacher at a Mississauga school. I have verified the existence and identity of its author and its authenticity." I don't know how he verified it's authentic. Does that mean the allegations are authentic? In any event, a very similar letter, not exactly the same, but a very similar letter was shared on Twitter. Cat was out of the bag, and then media reports followed, reporting on allegations that kids were doing this at this school. And nobody actually doing the investigation to find out whether or not this happened or not until earlier this week when the National Post reported it out. We're all traumatized. The inside story of a middle school in crisis. And I don't have any qualms about this investigation by Joseph Breen. It seems like a fairly even-handed job was done in trying to determine, talking to teachers. I don't know if Breen was able to get in touch with the accused students or not. That's really unclear from the piece. And, you know, the privacy of the students, no students are named. But, you know, I think, again, you could probably infer if you're part of this community which students are being talked about here. You can't ignore that, like, even though this was like a pretty straight ahead piece of reporting, the context is of like a school that's too woke, that refuses to discipline kids. And, you know, the National Post has an ideological bent in terms of which stories it chooses to report out. I don't know what to think about this. You know, Breen, like, he covered it and covered some of the context. And I'll quote here. "There is an element of racial politics in the board's approach to discipline. Some, but not all, the students involved in this misbehavior at Tompkins Road are black. Teachers say the students requiring intervention are of diverse ethnicities, but the administration is keenly alive to the risk of perpetuating anti-black racism through its responses." You know, and the narrative is the school won't discipline. They won't suspend kids, and these problematic kids are ruining it for everybody. But there is a wider context that Breen gets into. You know, there are studies that show that there's systemic racism and discipline in schools. Black students as young as junior kindergarten have been suspended in the Peel Board. Black students at the high school level have been punished at a level twice as high as non-black students. Jaskaran, I am unfamiliar with like news reports, exposés on the behavior of 11-year-olds. What do you think about this?
Yeah, this is a tough one to navigate as a Peel District School Board parent. This is concerning on multiple levels.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think the biggest criticism here is, especially from a school's perspective, that there are some privacy kind of rules and guidelines in place where you can't kind of expose these kids to harm. And we got to remember that these are kids. You know, kids do dumb things. Sure, Jesse, you and I have our share of stories when we were young kids in school. At like 11, 12, 13 years old, I was an idiot. You got to give a chance for kids to grow out of that. But having said that, you know, the teachers, if they have a story to tell here, like that's newsworthy that you have a school in trouble and you have an administration that's kind of turning a blind eye to it or not doing an effective job. And you're able to get enough, you know, in this case, anonymous sources where you can corroborate what was in the letter, you know, maybe there's an argument that you have a duty to report on it as well. Like there's a system that's broken that impacts all of our kids. Like, I don't know, maybe this is happening at my kid's school as well. I don't know.
Well, I forget the due diligence part, the corroboration, because while we were twiddling our thumbs debating the ethics of reporting this out or not, they just went live on social media and that was what actually prompted action. They got what they wanted. You know, the teachers had tried to deal with the principal. They'd even tried to go over the principal's head and talk to the superintendent. And it wasn't until they made this an issue on social media and then it got picked up as a result of it going viral on social media. Then the principal lost their job, the superintendent's at the school, the board stepped up and is doing something about this. And so it was, you know, maybe this is a happy story of them, you know, taking measures into their own hands and making an impact. And yet, you know, one thing that you find through Breen's reporting is that some of these accusations people say are not true. And I do wonder about, like, if that accusation is linked in people's minds to one kid and this is being nationally reported on. And then, of course, it goes through the opinion mill, and Rex Murphy comes out with this column, and my God, here's Rex Murphy. The board says it is committed to cultivating safe and inclusive learning and working environments for students and staff. Just what is this? It is the plasticine, flavorless, static verbiage that every school board pumps out from its vast cliche vat to stuff every one of the flaccid, sterile, yawn incantations it issues to cover some patent malfeasance, misfeasance, disorder, or parent complaint. Safe, inclusive environments, the tag stickers of the woke. And he just goes on and on. He's taking issue with their language at great length. All they're saying is they're trying to cultivate safe and inclusive learning and working environments for students and staff. That's pretty clean and clear use of language to me.
Yeah, well, the grand irony is Rex is the one using, best to sound smart.
From the vast sewer of bureaucraties. Like, it just gets politicized horribly. And like, yeah, these are kids. And, you know, I know how rumors go around schools. Like, I'm sure some of this stuff has happened. But, you know, like, oh, I heard that so-and-so said this to a teacher and... Like, what is the process here? Like, these little things can have such reverberations through people's lives, you know, when you get accused of doing something as a kid. And when you get the media involved with it, it can just sort of amplify the damage and this idea that you're, like, public enemy number one. I wasn't smearing feces on the walls, as best I can recall. You know, memory is foggy. But, you know, I remember when I got into trouble and when I was, you know, sometimes I deserved it and sometimes I was treated unfairly. And the idea that authorities are treating you unfairly when you're, like, 11 and trying to sort your shit out... No pun intended. You know, like, if that's in the National Post and Rex Murphy is, like, dunking on you, I don't know. When you're dealing with kids, I get pretty squinchy.
Yeah, it's a tough space to navigate. Like, if it's a teacher-led rebellion and this was just the escalation of their protests and they felt that they had nowhere to go but the press now, it says something that maybe this is a grander indictment of... You know, the board of the superintendents that ignored the principal not doing a good job. Because at the same time, you know, maybe the environment was terrible for these other kids. This is almost a relief of sorts that something's actually finally happening and being done.
Yeah, but I think you used the word environment. That sounds like woke bureaucraties to me there, Giscard. That is Shortcuts. Thank you for joining me. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. You can email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Giscard, where can people find you and your work?
Giscard_Sundhu on Twitter. And then you can always check BozNews.org on Twitter as well. That is where everything goes up.
That is BAAZ.org. This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Theme music is by So-Called, syndication by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. This week on The Backbench, Matea Roach interviews Aaron O'Toole. He stopped by our studios and Matea put the screws to him. It is definitely worth a listen. Matea Roach and Aaron O'Toole, check this out. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.